This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Wendell Potter spent more than 20 years as a public relations executive for health insurance companies. He worked for two of the nation's largest healthcare organizations, Humana and Cigna, and was a well-known spin doctor for the health insurance industry. Wendell Potter says that June 24, 2009 was quite possibly the scariest day of his life. On that day, Potter testified before a congressional committee on how health insurance companies purposefully confuse customers and dump the sick. He explained that insurance companies only want to satisfy investors. He documents that experience in his book, Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. And Wendell Potter is my guest today. Welcome to the program.
So thank you, Frank.
Tell us what you did. Describe your job at Cigna.
Well, as head of corporate communications, I was a person who was the main spokesman for the company. I was a person who approved messaging for the company. I was a person who was essentially a gatekeeper if for any reporter who wanted to interview one of our other executives. For example, if a reporter wanted to meet with or interview our CEO, I was a person that he or she would have to go through. I also worked at the industry level. I was a person who represented my companies, as you're right, I worked for Humana and Cigna, at the trade association level. And I worked with my peers, my counterparts at other companies to plan PR strategy, often to defeat healthcare reform or to shape reform in ways that would benefit the insurance industry.
And that's an interesting thing, I think, that we don't always think about, that in this business or in any business, we think of businesses in competition, each one of these companies. But in fact, at some level, they do get together and plot some kinds of strategies.
They do.
Particularly when it comes to legislation or
public absolutely.
Relations.
Yeah, they do. They compete. But they have common interest, and they want to make sure that they win in the marketplace. They all share that. And they want to, and to do that, they know they have to influence the way public policy is made. And to influence the making of public policy, they know that they have to influence public opinion. So part of my job was to do just that, to manipulate public opinion, to influence public policy.
When you were doing this, did you consider it spin? What were you thinking you were doing?
You know, when I first started working in the industry, I was a true believer. I felt that managed care, as I learned it, was a good way to provide and finance care in this country. And I rose up in the ranks at Cigna and Humana before that. But I learned things as I was climbing that corporate ladder that I didn't know early in my career. I came to understand what these companies do to make sure that they're making sure that they meet Wall Street's expectations, that they are satisfying shareholders. So I guess you'd say in the early part of my career, I seemed to be perfectly fine being a spin doctor because I felt that what I was doing was representing an honorable industry. I came to understand that I was not toward the end of my career.
And what led you to that conclusion?
Well, I became increasingly uncomfortable being a spokesman for an industry that I was able to see took a great deal – they engage in practices that resulted in more and more Americans not having any insurance coverage. They engage in practices, for example, of canceling insurance when someone gets sick and they don't want to pay those medical bills that are coming in. They will purge small businesses from their roles if an employee gets sick at a small business. Purging is a common practice in which an insurance company will raise the rates of a small business so high that that small business usually has no alternative, at least eventually, of canceling coverage for every employee. And I also was very much aware of the fact that insurance companies will not sell coverage to some people at any price if they've been sick. I learned ultimately that they're in business to avoid selling their products to people who really need it. We have 51 million people who are uninsured in this country.
How did that come to your attention? How did you find that out?
Well, because I was given the responsibility of serving as the financial spokesman for the company. I was the person who was on the phone dealing with reporters from the Wall Street Journal, Reuters, Bloomberg, Dow Jones, the New York Times. When the company announced earnings, Cigna and Humana both are publicly traded companies, and they have to announce earnings every 3 months. I was a person who had to understand how the company made money to be able to answer the questions that I knew I'd be getting from the Wall Street Journal and those other reporters. So I learned a lot that most people don't understand, don't ever get a chance to learn about how health insurance actually works in this country. So I got an education that I never would have expected or otherwise would have gotten.
Tell us how spin works.
Spin works by communicating in ways that connect with people emotionally. That's why during this healthcare reform debate that we had and during the campaigns, we're still hearing it. You heard that the legislation that was enacted by Congress was a government takeover of the healthcare system. Those words were very, very important. They were carefully chosen. They were put together in a certain way to make people think that the government was actually taking over our healthcare system. It was not true. But when you say something like that and you put those words together to scare people, it's part of a fear-mongering campaign. At the core of a lot of these efforts is a fear-based campaign to make people believe something that isn't necessarily so. But if you can persuade enough people that it is, for example, many, many people still believe that this legislation that was passed contains a provision creating death panels in the government. Many people believe that. There was never anything in the legislation that came close to that. But people think that it was in the bill. And if you can say, and again, the term death panels was specifically chosen, those words were to have an emotional punch and to mislead people.
And it's interesting that that was able to stick to the legislation, but not to the companies that were in fact engaging in that kind of practice with their rescissions, yeah. One of which really caught your attention, 17-year-old Nadaline Sarkeesian,
yeah. That's right.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, and your point, I appreciate your mentioning that point, because we've been led to fear government involvement in our lives much more than corporate involvement in our lives. And that's because corporations pretty much run our country these days in ways that people do not realize or understand. Nadaline Sarkeesian came down with she had leukemia. She was diagnosed with leukemia when she was 14. She was treated successfully, but it came back when she was 16. The treatments then were not too successful, and ultimately her doctors at UCLA, she lived in Los Angeles, said that she had to have a liver transplant to live. Her family was covered by an insurance policy from Cigna, where I worked, and that's how I came to be involved in this. I was a spokesman for the company at a time when her doctors requested coverage for the transplant, and Cigna said no. Cigna said, no, in our opinion, it's experimental. Despite what her treating physician said, Cigna, a medical doctor, a medical director 2,500 miles away in Pittsburgh, reviewing some paperwork, said he didn't think that she should be eligible for that liver transplant. Well, the family was so surprised. They were shocked, but they were not willing to give up. They rallied a lot of support. They were able to get the news media interested in this case. And long story short, they were able to bring so much pressure on the company that the company eventually decided to cover it. They changed course and agreed to cover it. But regrettably, so much time had passed from the original request until the time that Cigna agreed to do it, that her other organs were beginning to shut down. She died just hours after Cigna said it would cover the transplant. And that, I'm a parent. I have a daughter myself who was just a few years older than Nadaline at the time. Nadaline died when she was 17 years old. She died 5 days before Christmas in 2007. I had handled in my career a lot of what we called high-profile cases or horror stories, as they came to be called. And that was the last one I said I was ever going to do for the health insurance industry. There are death panels in this country, absolutely, and I was part of it, and they exist every day. If you fear that there will be a government bureaucrat standing between you and your doctor, what you really need to fear more than that, there is no such thing. There's nothing in this legislation that would create that, but you do have a potential bureaucrat standing between you and your doctor, and he or she works for a big corporation, more than likely, with the stock being traded on the New York Stock Exchange.
So, as you said, they make the decision to approve the doctor's recommendation or not, your rates or not,
right.
And then there are rescissions. And maybe you can explain that for us, and the number of people who lose health insurance once they start to get expensive.
Yeah, it happens all the time, and one of the things the legislation that was signed does try to end is this practice of rescission. There was a woman who testified before Congress just before I did, and she was testifying about getting a notice in the mail from her insurance company while she was in the midst of being treated for breast cancer that they were canceling her coverage. And she had been paying her premium. She didn't know why. And she finally found out that they said that they had found by looking, scouring her medical records, that she had been treated for acne at some time in the past and had failed to disclose that in the application she filled out to get insurance coverage. And they considered that to be justification for canceling her coverage. This is what our healthcare system is like in this country. If you can't get coverage through the workplace, then you have to fill out applications and buy it on your own in what's called the individual market. If you err, if you forget something, as this woman did, and you get sick or injured and you have high medical claims and the insurance company doesn't want to pay them, they will go back and look at your medical records. They have a lot of access to records about your life that people don't realize. And in her case, they left her having to pay the full amount of all of her medical bills pertaining to
because it's retroactive. So even if they've paid some of those bills, then they bill you, or you'll still be liable for those bills.
Oh, absolutely.
It could be hundreds of thousands.
Out of the goodness of their heart, they'll at least return the premiums that you've paid.
Tell us about
that. They're that nice.
Tell us about statistics and how they work, and how you were able to massage statistics to make it look as though people who are uninsured in this country just are irresponsible.
I was reminded as I was doing some of this work that one of my most memorable books in college was a book called How to Lie with Statistics. It never occurred to me when I was in that course that I would actually be doing that, but that's what you do. The U.S. Census Bureau, for example, every year comes out with a big report on the number of people who are unemployed and uninsured in this country. And so one of my jobs is to take that data was to slice and dice the data in such a way, and I was writing a white paper at the time, shortly toward the end of my career, and trying to persuade people that, hey, yeah, we may have 50 million people in this country who don't have insurance, but if you slice and dice the data in certain ways and characterize it in certain ways, you can make people believe that it's not a big deal. And that was part of my job. It was to make people believe that a lot of those folks are that way by choice. They just are shirking their individual responsibility. They don't want to pay the premiums. And a lot of these folks are young people who think they're invincible. So you can put together a set of data and make people believe almost anything.
And again, when you were doing that, did you have the sense that you were deliberately distorting a picture?
At that point, yes. I was beginning to get it. It occurred to me that what I was doing for a living was the exact opposite of what I was trying to do in my first career as a journalist. And as a reporter, I took it very seriously. I felt that I had an obligation to tell the truth as I knew it, if I could find it out. But what I was doing toward the end of my career clearly was misleading people and distorting reality and telling anecdotes or using data selectively to manipulate public opinion. When that finally dawned on me, I knew that I was in the wrong line of work.
The turning point for you seemed to be, at least according to the book, a visit back to your home county, Wise County, Tennessee. Tell us about that.
Well, it was actually Wise County, Virginia. I was born in North Carolina in the mountains. I grew up on the other side of the mountains in East Tennessee. I was visiting relatives in the summer of 2007, picked up the local newspaper and read about something called a healthcare expedition that was being held across the state line in Wise County, 50 miles up the road, a very remote county. I was curious because it said that this was the eighth year it was being held. People were expected to drive from North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Ohio, all around the area. People were driving 400 and 500 miles to get free care that was being provided over 3 days in this little town by doctors from throughout Virginia who were volunteering their time. I was curious, actually I was in the midst of writing this white paper I mentioned to tell people that people were largely uninsured because they wanted to be that way. And I was stunned when I got there because I saw people who were lined up by the hundreds, and they were soaking wet because it had been raining that morning, lined up to get care that was being provided in animal stalls and barns. And it hit me like a bolt of lightning, finally, that what I was doing for a living was partially making it necessary for these people to get care in barns and animal stalls. And these could have been people, and more than likely were, some people who were in line, I bet, were people I grew up with. I made a commitment to myself at that moment that I would not be doing what I was doing very much longer.
Let's talk about this industry, the public relations industry, and how effective it is When you put a campaign together, when you work with other insurance companies at the trade level to come up with a campaign, how much research is it? It seems to be very effective, right? And the critique, anyone who would suggest that, for instance, corporations are people and so they should be able to spend as much money on campaigns, look, they have a right to influence public opinion like anybody else. Does that influence the fact that there's so much money really have an impact on public opinion?
Oh, my gosh. Yes. And here's the thing. We don't realize this, but the premium dollars that we pay for our coverage, a lot of it is skimmed off to pay for these campaigns. So we finance these campaigns of misinformation and lies. We pay for the lobbying campaigns and the advertising campaigns. We just don't know it. And that's why I wrote the book Deadly Spin, partly to try to educate people as to how this happens. But yes, an enormous amount of our money that we spend in premium dollars goes to pay for research, goes to pay for the use of linguists, goes to pay for focus groups, goes to pay people who are in the business of writing sound bites and talking points and phrases like a government takeover of the healthcare system. I never said anything, to tell you the truth, when I was in the industry that wasn't previously approved to say. I would never go off the reservation and say something that was not approved by the industry or my company.
Approved by way of testing. So it's
absolutely.
Not just a bunch of guys
absolutely.
Sitting around thinking this
will work. Exactly. Yeah. When I knew the words to use to make sure if I wanted to be quoted, I knew the words to use.
When you also talked about the industry using a lot of this public relations money to build front organizations to make it seem like a grassroots movement.
Right. Yeah. And again, our premium dollars pay for these front groups. There was a time just right the month before I went to Wise County, I was a part of an industry-wide effort to discredit Michael Moore and his movie Sicko, which came out in the summer of 2007. And the industry was very much afraid of Michael Moore, and they were afraid that his movie Sicko would persuade more and more people to think that we really had some serious problems with our healthcare system in this country, which we really do. But the effort was to try to discredit Michael Moore. Hundreds of thousands of dollars were spent, again, of premium dollars, to try to make people think that Michael Moore was outside of the mainstream of American thought, that the movie was fiction. We even went to the point of, in our internal memos, calling him Hollywood. But we also hired a PR firm, a big Washington-based PR firm, to set up a front group that was called Healthcare America, purporting to be a grassroots organization. But it was nothing more than the invention of special interest to create something that was not reality, didn't even have a legitimate address. And it was operated out of a big PR firm based in Washington, D.C. It took out ads in newspapers. It disseminated press releases. And it even fooled reporters into thinking that this was a legitimate organization.
Well, let's talk about that. We've got only about a minute left. But what's our responsibility in the media? It seems like we're culpable in this as well.
We are. And I wrote this book as much for journalists as for anybody because I think it's important for journalists to be skeptical just as it is for anyone. You can't really trust that an organization is legitimate. You have to do a little bit of research. I mean, even the New York Times was quoting someone from Healthcare America as if it were a legitimate organization. You have to do some research. You can't just accept that it's as purported to be.
Wendell, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you, Frank.
Wendell Potter is the author of Deadly Spin. He's going to be talking tonight at Quail Ridge Books and Music in Raleigh. That's at 7:30. It is co-sponsored by the North Carolina Policy Watch. For more information, go to quailridgebooks.com. The book is called Deadly Spin. Coming up, Deaver, Jeffrey Deaver. We're going to meet the Chapel Hill writer who is taking over the James Bond book franchise. Stay with us.